Welcome to Identity, a series brought to you by ID Magazine. Join me, Mahoro Seward, ID's Senior Fashion Features Editor, as I explore the enduring legacy of some of the last four decades' most influential subcultures and the guiding figures within them. As you know, this season, we're taking a different tack, with each episode focusing on an artist whose life and work are anchored in subculture. Today, we're speaking to Suzanne Bartsch, a veritable New York nightlife legend known for the era-defining parties she's been throwing in the city since the 80s and the transportive look she's pulled for them.
The chaos of what I created is actually what was the success of it, other than the clothes were pretty. They'd never seen anything like it. Drag queens were flying across, like on trapezes, passing joints to people. Everyone wanted to be part of this new London in New York. I always viewed my clubs as a place where people can come and express themselves, be whoever they want to be. You feel like you belong.
From her early Savage parties beneath the Chelsea Hotel, through to her legendary weekly parties at the Copacabana in Hell's Kitchen, and, of course, her organising of the Love Ball, putting on events has always been a way for Suzanne to create a sense of community, as well as a hell of a lot of, well, pretty hazy memories along the way. In our chat, we discuss how she's found herself at the heart of basically every significant subcultural scene in London and New York since the late 60s, discovering the likes of Amanda Lepore and RuPaul, turning partying into trailblazing AIDS activism, and her new book, which chronicles some of the unbelievably wild tales you're about to hear. Most important of all, though, is the abiding generosity at the heart of everything she does. Without further ado, Suzanne Bartsch. First of all, hi, Suzanne.
Okay, nice to meet you.
Tell us a bit about where you are right now, this incredible backdrop.
I'm in my Chelsea Hotel apartment. I'm like a Chelsea girl, baby. And this is my living room / office / sex parlor / veterinarian. I have a cat.
And if I'm not mistaken, you've lived in the Chelsea Hotel since you arrived in New York. Correct?
Yeah, I'm here since 81.
Hey, incredible. I mean, we're obviously going to come back onto, New York and your role as sort of like one of the, an ambassador, a cultural ambassador almost of the city in greater depth. But I wanted to kind of talk a bit about your life before you arrived in New York, taking it all the way back to Bern, where you were born and grew up. And what was it like for you growing up there?
It was very... get married, a banker, have children, a car and a house, which is everything I didn't want to do. And that's how come I left. I knew that I should leave in order to find who I really am, what I am about. I knew I had to leave home. And I was like 8 years old when I said to my mom, when I'm 16, I'm going to be gone. And she goes, okay, well, like nodded her head. And then when I was 16-ish, I definitely indeed left. I also have all these friends at that time that were all going to London. The London scene was really happening, and it was in the 60s, and the London was just crazy, incredible. These people that I was hanging out with, they were all in their 20s. I was always with older friends. They were talking about London all the time, and they would go for the weekend. So I said, that's where I have to go, London. Mm-hmm. I went to London and fell in love with London.
But when you were still in Switzerland, I guess, perhaps as a teenager, was it in that age when you were still in Bern that you started to kind of explore the potential of fashion? Yeah. And the expressive potential of it?
Yeah, my background is looks. I started very young. I was apparently a nightmare to get dressed before I could walk and speak. I had very particular ideas of what I wanted to wear and drove my mother crazy. I just loved putting things together, and I would put things together that weren't what you're supposed to do. Like I would do a little frilly Sunday frock with like heavy boots and knee socks, patent leather shoes. I switched things around at a very early age. And then before I was 10, I wanted to go shop at the Salvation Army. It's called Brockenhaus in Switzerland. And it's a place where you buy secondhand clothes, and you just wouldn't be seen there if you, like, that means you're poor. Not that there was anything wrong to be poor, but it wasn't what you do, you know, shop secondhand clothes. And that's all I wanted to do. But my parents were really cool and they were very supportive of everything. And my mom let me go and shop there instead of buying things from the equivalent of like H&M and, you know, those stores that they have everywhere. So I was into switching it up very early in life. It's kind of my passion.
And was that sort of sensibility, that sort of early commitment to pulling looks, was that something that drew you to London?
It was more the energy. I heard, you know, rock, sex and rock and roll. I know it sounds really good. I'm going over the, you know, how much fun it was. You know, things didn't close at 10 o'clock at night like they do in Bern. And I just wanted to go live the life. So maybe you could actually live the life, you know. And I wasn't really motivated by, oh, I want to buy looks or fashion. But of course, it came without saying that the fashion, I mean, that whole King's Road scene and Carnaby Street, they were all like, you heard about that, you know. And it was a big, big movement happening in London. Incredibly creative. So I knew that that was going to be a no-brainer, you know, be involved in turning it over there.
Could you paint a bit of a picture of what the London that you arrived in was like?
I got there before punk. It was really the rock and roll, the Rolling Stones, the Led Zeppelins. I was hanging out with all those guys. And then the speakeasy was the one where everybody went and you could go there and be very anonymous. So that was full of rock stars and groupies and cool people. And that was in the West End. And, you know, going to, what's that place where they all performed? I just can't remember. My mind is all over the place. Huh? The Marquee, thank you. I got Walid, he's the genius over here. So a lot of bands got their start there. So I, when I was in London, it was very, like Vern Lambert, who's an Australian genius, he was selling Fortuny dresses and 20s beaded dresses. And because I already was wanting to shop secondhand in Switzerland, London was brilliant for that. I started to wear 20s dresses. I wore like crepe de chine 40s dresses, these floral prints. And Vern became a friend and he had a store at Chelsea Market. So I ended up having a store there myself. I ran his store when he moved to Milan. But the King's Road, also that time, the King's Road was really happening. And then the punk scene came along. You know, Vivian Westwood and the Sex Shop opened, the punks happening. After a little while, there was like Jordan and all these incredible people doing punk. And I was doing Babe, like my version of Babe. it kind of, I was very in the 20s vibe. You know, I would have a bob or wear bobs. I liked wigs all my life, so I would wear wigs. And unfortunately, I don't have many pictures of that time at all. Yeah, so I did a lot of, you know, Portobello Road was going, and also Brick Lane was an incredible shopping place on the weekend. And it was this completely disorganized piles of old secondhand clothing. And you could get something incredible for like 50 pence. Yeah. And then the punk thing happened and what was the question?
No. I was just asking about, you know, what the London that you arrived in was like. And I mean, I know that, I guess, towards the latter part of your time in London, that you were hanging out a lot with the Blitz Kids as well, no?
Okay, so on the New Romantics in the like late 70s, then it went New Romantic, which was just fantastic. Like Blitz was on a Monday. Somebody said it was on a Tuesday, but I think it was a Monday, if you ask me. Really check and see when the Blitz Club was. And that was Steve Strange started this club. And it was fantastic. Every week, everybody had completely new looks.
Tuesdays.
It was Tuesdays? Oh, wow. Okay, it was Tuesday. I could have sworn it was. I know it was the beginning of the week. But we would dance as couples, you know, very mechanical. They played a lot of Kraftwerk music. And we would dance like very robotically to the music, like, everyone danced the same moves. It was, I wish I had footage of it. Everyone was doing the same move, without saying anything. We just did the same. There was also the Club Hell. I mean, the one-night clubs became really popular. When I first went there, I feel maybe I'm wrong here. Like, I'm not good historically and I'm forgetting names. It's not my age, it's just too much going on. But I want to say that there wasn't really any one-night clubs earlier on. I feel like the one-night stand started later on.
So what was it that compelled you to first go to New York? Because obviously, I assume that you had visited the city before you eventually moved in 1981.
By the way, I had a knitwear business in London. I had a knitwear in the early 70s. I had a knitwear business. I used to have these ladies knit from me from Cricklewood to Herne Hill. Yeah, it's London is not designed, at least then. I don't know how it is now. I think it's still the same. It's not designed to, you know, New York is up and down, left and right, and everything is organized. It's so easy psychologically to go, oh, I got to go buy buttons and thread and fabric. They're all in the same neighborhood. Whereas in London, for the buttons, you have to go to Herne Hill. For the wool, you got to go to Cricklewood. Everything is all over the place, you know. I think that's one way, which is way. When I came to New York, I really was able to execute what, you know, thinking becomes simple here. London's a jigsaw. This is just like a grid here.
You mentioned that it was that sort of one night party culture that was kind of arising in London through things like Blitz. That was what inspired you in the way that you approach your parties in New York. Yeah. And I was just wondering about that move to New York, because I assume that you'd been there before you moved there.
And I remember coming here, and I hated it. It was too hot. It was so hot. I think it was in the summer or something. I was boiling, and I was here, like, saying, I can't live here. But I saw the most incredible things, like Divine with the woman behind Barclay was incredible. And then there was, like, Gilda Grape Club, where it was, like, a bar club where drag queens were flying across, like, on trapezes, passing joints to people. No nets, no safety net. They're just flying, like, having a drink, and a drag queen was flying by on a trapeze, trying to hand you point. It was absolutely fantastic. Ian Schrager told me that he was inspired by that club for the Studio 54. That was one of his inspirations. And I saw that, and then there was like incredible. The studio opened, of course, which is like, it was a huge thing. And I happened to be here, and I went, I didn't know them really or anyone really. And I went there, like, I was dressed up head to toe in this gold jewelry, gilt. It wasn't gold, but it looked like gold. And Steve Rubell saw me, and there's millions of people, and somehow I got in. I was like, come in. And I became friends with him after that, even before I moved here. And Steve Rubell was Ian Schrager's partner in Studio 54. But I didn't think I would live here. So then I went back in February of 91. I met Patrick Hughes. I don't know if you know who he is. He's a painter. He used to be Molly Parkinson's. They were married, him. But they split up. I met him probably in 1979, and we had an affair and we got involved, and then he said, come to New York for Valentine's. So he was living in New York at the Chelsea Hotel and at the Chelsea Arts Club in London. And so I came for a love affair, and I never left. I fell in love with New York.
The room in the Chelsea Hotel that you're currently in?
Yeah, he gave me the apartment.
Okay.
Yeah. Once they had they used to have gangbangs here over there in the corner.
If the walls could talk.
Kinky parties. Kinky parties, yeah. And came, and I just, I never left. That's how I got to New York, a love affair.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Whilst I was here, I noticed that there wasn't really many looks. Like if you wore a flower, a fake flower in your hair, you were like done up, you know. And I went to the Metropolitan Opera in 81 for David Hockney's opera, where he did the sets. And I was the most dressed person there. And Bill Cunningham saw me, who came over and said, oh, my God, who are you? I said, oh, I'm Suzanne. Where are you from? Your accent. I said, Switzerland. I live in London. And he named me the Swiss Miss. And he always called me Swiss Miss after that. We became really good friends. And I missed the constant, the looks. I missed the whole culture of turning looks. So Patrick is actually the one who said this line. I claim the line, but it's his line. He said, why not import what you miss? And I'm like, why not? At that point, I was still going to London to, I was going to the flea markets here, buying stuff. They had amazing things here, cheap and amazing jewelry and stuff. So I would shop here at 40s gilded jewelry and take it to London because I still had my antique store at the Chelsea Market. So I would go back and forth. So like I came in February, by May, I said, I'm opening a store.
And that was the Suzanne Barge.
Yeah. So I said, where do I open the store? I went to the most deserted area, it was Soho. There was nobody there but truck drivers parking their trucks. And this one store, a makeup, Shiseido, I think it was Shiseido, it was a makeup store. Mm-hmm. And Robert Lee Morris was down there with his works, with his studio, a jeweler who did all the jewelry for Donna Karan and a really strong jeweler. And that's all there was. So I loved that it was so like a desolate place and trucks. And I'm going, and the rent, of course, would be a good rent because nobody wants to have a shop there. Mm-hmm. And I met landlord and he told him what I was going to do. And I think he really liked the idea. He knew it was a good idea bringing London fashion to New York because it was lacking here.
And who were the designers that you were working with?
Yeah, so I opened this store. I saw Stephen Jones, Andrew Logan, Dinny Hall, Body Map, David Hall, chemise. The chemise was a big new romantic thing. Do you know about the chemise? David Hall. Jewelry, more jewelry and hats. Michael Kostis designed. So when I found the shop, Michael and I really respected him and I love his work. And I called him up, I said, Michael, you have to come and fix it, this shop. You have to come over to New York. So I brought him over and he did the shop for me. We opened in September of 81. And before, 2 weeks before I opened, the New York Times, John Duca, which had this agency called Kipo Kawako Duca. He saw what I was doing and he was freaking out. And he gave me a whole page in the New York Times before I opened. He said, this is incredible. And he's the person that brought out the word street fashion. He labeled it street fashion. So I had a big opening because people read about it in the Times, you know, before. Mm-hmm. So it was a big success.
Of course, you're known for, being such a key figure in importing these, what are now sort of these canonical names in fashion history to New York. I mean, John Galliano, Vivienne Westwood.
Westwood, yeah, I had brought them all. Then I needed a bigger place. Actually, the way that happened was, my shop was really drawing attention to London and everybody wanted to go to London, Barney's, Bloomingdale's, Saks, to London. I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to get like Macy's. I want to just like disappear. Hey, my little box in Thompson's, what do I do? So I decided to put on a fashion show in May 83.
Was this New London in New York?
Yeah, and I called it New London in New York, and I went to London, and I asked Judy Blaine, I asked everybody to be Lee Bowery. Lee Bowery and Rachel Oberon were in my first store. I already had them in my first store also. So I did this fashion show, and I had everybody in it, Stephen Jones. It was amazing. So and then Michael Kosoff did the set for the show. It was at the Roxy, which at that time was a roller rink turned disco where all the break dancing was happening. And there was like a line around the block, twice around the block, a double line. And I had no idea what I was doing because I never did a fashion show before. So I was like seating the wrong people next to the, like the Barneys were sitting with Bloomingdale's. It was all a mess. But the chaos of what I created is actually what was the success of it. Other than the clothes were pretty, they'd never seen anything like it. So their shows in New York are very organized, Calvin Klein style. Beautiful, chic, perfect. Mine was such chaos. Not only did I seat everyone in the wrong place, I didn't think about the sound. So we had this huge space. We put up this structure that Michael Kostiff made, and it was like fabric stuff. And the room was divided. The music was blasting. So out front, that was great. But backstage, you couldn't hear a fucking thing. Nobody knew who was who. So if you said Lee Bowie, you're on. Judy Blaine would go out. You know, it was really great.
Right.
It was absolutely fantastic. And we had like these great supermodels were doing the show for free because they knew it was going to be fun. Everyone wanted to be part of this new London in New York. And we sold like over $650,000 worth of clothes from that show.
Wow.
But, wow, there's your wow. Nobody was there. People weren't able to deliver. I'm a real organic person. I feel something, I'm doing it. I'm not afraid. Of course, I'm afraid sometimes, but I don't let fear run my life. I go for it. I feel it. I go for the excitement. Dollar bills, I want them, but they don't excite me. The artistry, the energy, the people's joy is what excites me.
But am I correct in thinking that it was actually out of the store that you started running parties, almost as creating spaces for people to be able to wear these eccentric, extravagant looks that you were kind of bringing to the New York market?
That's exactly what happened. I ended up getting a bigger store. I did another show. I went to Japan and did 3 days of shows in Tokyo in front of the prime minister. I opened a big store on Broadway, West Broadway, where Michael again did the decor. It was inspired by tile, Gaudi tile, broken tile. It was stunning. And then I was in the store a few months, I guess a year or so, and I was going down at the Chelsea Hotel. I was going out. I saw leaving the hotel, and I suddenly saw some building happening, construction. And I looked, and there was this, somebody was building like a 1970s disco in the middle of the 80s. And it was so tacky and so wrong. It was brilliant. So I'm going, oh, my God, I have to do something here. Why? I'm going, why? Because I'm selling all this drag and people have to have a place to show it off because everything at the moment was very like Nels, French fries and European dance floor or the Trax Club, which were like shirts off, you know, the gay community, topless shirts off, dark. No lighting. I wanted something really bright, high energy, show off your looks. And that's what I went and did downstairs at the Savage. Called Sauvage. It was owned by this guy, Leo, who was, I guess, I would say might have been mafia because he ended up getting shot point blank in his head.
Oh, wow. Okay. Only in New York.
He was a rough guy, I could tell. Yeah. But he was great. He taught me, he said, oh, when I saw them build the club, they didn't have a liquor license. He said, oh, I'd love to calm down, do something. We don't have a liquor license. I said, forget it. We can't do this without. And then a few months later, the phone rang and it was Leo. Hey, I got a liquor license. And I went downstairs 5 minutes later to deal. And I opened like 2 weeks later.
So that was your formal entrance into kind of, yeah, transitioning from like the store to formally having nightlife as your main endeavor, right?
And yeah, in a way, it was a form of event. And the fashion show was my first event that I really did, and that was such a like a high, like it was so rewarding, and the beauty of having all these people come to something that's in your head and your heart and you make it happen, and then you see this joy across this massive crowd. It's beautiful. So I want more. So then in a way the nightclub thing was an extension. It's events. So
totally. You were saying that it was, in a way, the parties that you were doing were a response to this kind of divided New York club scene. On the one hand, this kind of quite dark, like gay, not necessarily sex club, but sort of like quite sexually charged dark gay scene. And then this kind of more prissy, polite scene.
So the gay parties had high energy, they had great music, but then there's no looks. So I wanted high energy music, disco. I had Sister Dimension come. Big Sue came and DJed. She was from London. I don't know where she is now. And then I had Sister Dimension eventually DJ from me, who is the person that created the Pyramid Club in the early 80s. So that's another legend. Yeah, so I got into that with the Savage, and then Savage was going great. I started with me by myself hosting it, and then I wanted to grow. And I'm always one thing that I very my driving force. It's I like to grow. I needed to do more and learn more and expand. And I wanted a place where I could play two sounds: the disco sound on one floor and the house music on another floor. So I moved to Bentley's. I kept Savage for a little while, and the Bentley's was a Wednesday night, and there I would have drag queens on the first floor with Sister Dimension doing disco, and then upstairs I would have house music with the celebrating the striptease culture. And it wasn't about sex, it was about the art of striptease. I really admire how they move, and it was an art, it's an art. So I had like Lady Hennessy Brown, Honeydew, who had like huge boobs like Honeydews. And then Lady Hennessy Brown was the star, who was like this Amazon woman. She had just had twins, and she would come to the club and squeeze her boobs, and the milk would come flying out. And it was so sensational and outrageous that people would come with teacups, umbrellas. It was a huge scene.
Come with your bottles, get your fill.
I know, get your vitamins. Ah, the fountain of youth. And then she kept doing that, and the milk keeps coming if you're doing that, you know. Oh my God, we had so much fun. So that was Bentley's. And then the Bentley owner was the son of the Copacabana owner. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, do you know the Cope? And I said, well, yeah, I heard of it, but I never really went. Andy Warhol once had a party there. So I went and I gagged. It was incredible. So he said, do you want to win? Parties, and I said, yeah, once they gave me once a month a Thursday, and then the once a month Cope party started, and they were like massive. So, yeah, and that's also when I did a Halloween. It was a Halloween, first Halloween, who became legendary. My whole Halloween culture came from that one event that I did at the Red Parrots. Cher was having a perfume launch that night. I went to her launch, and then they all came to my Halloween, and I had the strippers, the drag, I had everything. It was wild. And it wasn't good for money because there were all these people don't pay, which are the people that get the word out, to be honest. But it wasn't good financially, but it made my Halloween forever. It was like so good. I'm still living off it. So it was worth it. You can't buy that with money.
No. Yeah. I mean, there's certainly experiences and memories and images that you certainly can't buy and can only live.
Yeah, it was very decadent.
Absolutely. But when was it along that timeline that you first kind of came across, I guess, the generation that would later go on to be known as the Club Kids? I mean, you know, RuPaul, Amanda, all of these people that you essentially discovered and brought into your parties as part of the furniture almost.
Right. So like in 85, the limelight was opening. I was friends with Peter Gation. I was about to start parties and he kind of helped me for a little while with the store. And then, the limelight was slightly going downhill. And I told, he said, will you do something at my club? Because I kind of owed him. And I said, not really. No, I don't want to do anything here. But I'll hook you up with somebody. He's going to be perfect for you. He's young, he's ambitious, he's a club kid. His name is Michael Alec. And they decided to do this party monster on a Wednesday. And that's how that happened. I put them together. Mm-hmm. And I went on talk shows with them, you know, like Ronaldo Herrera or Joan Rivers. Joan Rivers, they would have us, they had them on talk shows, but they always had me as well because I was maybe more. I was not a club kid, but I embraced it and I wanted it, but I didn't want to be a club kid. This is what I'm saying. I don't plan. I don't sit.
They were just in the circuit.
I'm not planning. I'm sitting here at 12 o'clock to meet you. I don't plan. I do. That's like, I go by instinct. So basically, they were in my life. I was in their life. So, and then the look thing, I mean, like, doing looks, I encouraged, my whole thing with nightclubs was encouraging looks because I dressed up. People felt okay to dress up. In fact, they felt like they had to dress up. So for me, you know, at that time we didn't have Instagram. Did we even have a cell phone? The Copacabana was a real gallery. People came to look to see what's happening. Fashion trends came out of there. Manfred, Terry Mugler, met everybody, Connie Girl, Soldi, myself through the Copa. Gautier would be there, Marc Jacobs, everybody was there. It was kind of like a gallery, and I always viewed my clubs and my events as a place where people can come and express themselves, be whoever they want to be. It's a safe place, and it's you feel like you belong. And that was my mission message. This is why I'm doing this, to unite, to love, to give, to care. express myself, you know. And I really appreciate the efforts that these kids make. And so that's kind of been one of my motivations to do events, so I can have the mix of people is very important. I like to have everything at my parties. So, Walid knows what I'm forgetting to say. He was saying, and it's true, you'll see. I feel like I sounds really grandiose, but I feel like I invented inclusivity, honestly, you know. I mean, the drag queens were in the gutter. People would say, oh, drag queens. At one point, they would call me a drag queen and say, we can't hire her, she's a drag queen. Like, you know what I mean? It was looked down on. Drag queens from the world, and I set the stage for that. And then RuPaul took it and made it a huge movement, you know. I mean, it's amazing. He worked for me for a long time. And, the drag, I had them when I did the Love Ball, when the AIDS crisis hit. I did the Love Ball out of pain. I was in pain. Half of my address book was crossed out. All these incredible people are dying. It was very scary. I mean, I remember going in 81. My first encounter with AIDS was in 81. 82, 81, when I went to the hospital to visit Klaus Normi. We had to have a hazmat suit. And the only person who there is Joey Ehrlich, was very, very close to Klaus. He put the suit on because they wouldn't let him in. And then when he was in the room with Klaus, he took it off and said, I'm not wearing this fucking thing. And they were flipping out. I was there when that happened. The hospital didn't know. They didn't know what it was, you know. So out of pain and grief and anger, I created the Love Ball because it was a place I felt like we needed to celebrate that we are alive. And there's many people affected with AIDS. I wanted to celebrate. And it became a real cultural, political statement.
But I think that it's interesting that, I mean, what you were saying earlier about this notion of care being such a fundamental aspect of what motivates you in your desire to bring people together. And I guess the Love Ball is a real testament to that care on such a profound and radical extent, because it also raised, like, was it $2.5 million?
Yeah, over three. I did another one. We raised $1 million there, so we're close to four now. Mm-hmm. I also, you know, need to point out that not just myself, but every single person worked for free. The whole energy of people giving, it's priceless, the beauty of that, you know. And then, of course, whoever was at the Love Ball had to pay. You know, the tables were 10 grand and you had to pay to be on stage. That's how we raised the money. Because the idea for the Love Ball came after I went to Harlem House Ball. And so Sunday night, they used to be on a Sunday, and I came on, I was really depressed and with this AIDS thing. And that community was very much stricken by AIDS, the Harlem House community. And I'm going, what can I do? And I said, I can whine, bitch, and complain or fight. So I said, I'm going to fight. And I had that idea. Oh, my God, why don't I do a house ball with Barney's New York, Swatch, Armani, Donna Karan? I'm going, then how? Because with the house queens, I'm not going to get any money from. They have no money. So I'm like, I'll involve the house community, but bring the fashion community in, and they can pay and buy tables. And that was it.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, it's definitely something that's gone down in history as one of the most significant and, I guess, a landmark gesture in AIDS activism and culture being used as a platform for...
And the Love Ball inspired the Life Ball in Vienna, you know, which became this huge movement. That's where Gary Kersler came to the Love Ball. He said, I want to do this. He tried to get me involved fully, but I couldn't. But I was always supporting it and going there and doing things for them. I win every year. I think I missed 2 years of the 17 years or something that they did. Yeah.
But just coming back onto the conversation about fashion and you being, I guess, one of the most sort of, one of New York's most emblematic fashion figures, I would say. And obviously that was paid testament to in the exhibition that you did with Valerie Steele at the museum at FIT, which was a real celebration of the looks that you've pulled over the years and kind of given to the city. It's quite a generous gesture, I think, in many ways. But I wanted to ask you, I mean, fashion has been a motivating force in your relationship with nightlife. But how would you describe your relationship to fashion now? And how do you think it sort of developed over time?
I mean, it's still really important to me. The fact is, you can be anything. Buy your fashion, makeup, and hair. You can be whatever you want. If you feel like this today, I'm going to be that. And all you have to do is pull the clothes and style yourself. I mean, fashion is such an incredible tool, you know, for self-expression. What's changed is more, I mean, clearly it's become more multifaceted. Like, I love the guys wearing what I wear now, you know. I love the boys when they wear corsets, even if they're not twinks, you know what I mean? The men, it's just, I love the evolution of everything being more generous, more open. You wear a skirt, no one would look at you now in a skirt and say, you, what's wrong with you? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And that's a huge, I think that's an amazing evolution towards the right direction, you know. In a way, it's like those days, women weren't allowed to wear pants, you know, that whole time, the 20s, the 30s, where seeing above the ankle was like a disaster, corrupting somebody, you know. It's kind of in a way the same way because it's so evolved. And mm-hmm. I love that it's very unisex. I mean, I like the androgynous of the fashion now a lot.
And of course, I mean, you're still throwing parties today regularly in New York. Is it Le Bain and the McKittrick Hotel?
I do different things. Yeah, the McKittrick, I have, so rather than what I seem to be thriving on myself, feeling good about this, I have different type of things. So the Standard, Le Bain, there I do a party called Boom, which is the whole 18th floor of the Standard. And the Le Bain is a weekly summer party, Tuesdays, where I do it May to October. And that's more for like a fashion, cozy, cocktail-y, beautiful roof views and some dancing element with it. The dancing and the music, very important. Then I do the Kunst party, which is more of a big people coming together. It's like art meets dance, and it's very much about dancing and art, the looks. Then I do like a show called Bartram Folio. Now it's called New York, New York. And that one is just like a completely Mad Hatter fashion meets opera meets Mad Hatter.
Okay.
Pole dancing, there's what have I got in there? There's like girls making, Julie Atlas makes peanut butter sandwiches with her pussy. Right, and then I have this Brent, he draws, you could draw your portrait with his penis and you would recognize yourself. It's just really eclectic, but then there's also very beautiful, like Joey Arias is singing, Amanda does a show. It's like usually about 12 acts.
Mm-hmm.
Really eclectic. It's not burlesque. There is burlesque in it, but it's not. It's very fashion opera.
Mm-hmm.
Another one called Working Girls, which I do at different places, but I'm probably going to start a month at the Soho Grand because they have a really nice room there. And I like the intimacy of a small room also where people actually bump into each other, want to stop and say something, rather than in a big club where you bump into somebody because you want to try and get somewhere, you know. So the Working Girl is like, it's like an event where there's Working Girl Salon. It's celebrating the Working Girls. So I have striptease and real Working Girls before. And boys.
And just to come on to your, because I'm conscious of not keeping you for too long, just wanted to ask you about your book that you said is coming out. Is it in May, correct?
Yeah, actually it's on pre-sale now. It's on pre-sale and it comes out May 28th. I do a book signing on the 23rd. It's called Barchland and it's kind of a timeline. It's like a lot of photos, like quotes about certain things. So you get a good taste of what we're talking about today.
Why did you feel that now was the most sort of, you know, apt time to put together a book that has this sort of retrospective, reflective, chronological?
Honestly, there's really nothing to it. It's like the exhibition. It was, I need to do an exhibition, show my looks. I mean, the FIT was an incredible project. So it was the same with the book. I wasn't looking. I have a book from the FIT to go with the exhibition. I don't know if you saw that. Yeah, so the book just came along and it seems like the right time. And Mm-hmm. And I had this Walid helping me. Like, I couldn't have done it without this friend who was really incredible to make it happen. Yeah, it felt really good.
But just to round us out, is there a particular night that you cite as one that really sticks out in your memory as one that's...
That will be tonight. To me, what's happening tonight is going to be the most important night. I don't have this kind of a thinking. I mean, honestly, the Love Ball, you know, the communities coming together, the beauty, the energy, the giving. I remember standing on stage at the first Love Ball and I was bowing or something, thank you with the arms out, like a yoga pose or something, not planned. and the energy from the crowd went kind of through my hands into my body. It was like an out-of-body experience. It was incredible. Yeah. And it went back out to the people. That's how beautiful it was.
Totally. No, it's been such an honor, really, listening to you. You've been, a real pleasure to speak with. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time.
Thank you for having me. And I hope I didn't ramble and fix me up with your editing. Mr. Editor.
Thanks again to Suzanne for sharing her stories with us this week. And to the team who are instrumental in bringing Identity to life. My co-host Osman Ahmed, researcher Ailey Duffy, producer Amelia Phillips, and audio production team Robin Lieben and Simon Williams at Podmasters. Oh, and thanks to you for listening. Join us next time when I'll be speaking to queer punk provocateur and master of shock cinema, Bruce LaBruce.